Good morning. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind Radio. The Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. The Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This morning, I, Jane, will be reading to you from the Sentinel and Enterprise and a few other magazines that we have here. Dottie is not here, my cohort, because she has obligations at home with her husband. Now, the Lowell Association for the Blind would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. And now from the Sentinel. Let's see. Here we go. A mastery that is both disciplined and daring. And this is from Fitchburg. Gallery Marquis presenting a deep new solo show by Court Couture fashion designer. Okay. Gallery Marquis is presenting a deep look, a new solo show by couture fashion designer and artist Rachel Xavier, founder of Valentino Ventura XX. According to a press release, the exhibition that runs through December 27th at the 699 Main Street Gallery offers an immersive view into more than 3 years of Xavier's evolving creative work, a vision defined by precision, edge, and hand-built couture craftsmanship. The creative signature approach centers on experimental material use, particularly sculptural hand-stitched nylon construction, which balances architectural clarity with elevated edgy sophistication. A deep look traces the evolution of that language from her earliest inspiration to the presentation of her newest work, including pieces from her bridal couture collection, where elegance and conceptual edge converge. Rachel Xavier's work demonstrates a mastery that is both disciplined and daring, said Gallery Marquis Executive Director Dina Vasquez. Helping bring her vision to life for a deep look has been a privilege. Her ability to craft modern couture with intentionally in artistry places her among the most compelling emerging designers today. And this exhibition offers a rare and intimate view of her vision. The opening reception of the exhibit held on November 29th provided the opportunity to meet the designer, experience the full installation, and celebrate the unveiling of her newest collection, a special one-night-only runway presentation debuting Zaya's newest couture and bridal pieces, giving guests the rare opportunity to experience her sculptural designs in motion. Xavier recently returned to the U.S. after several years living and working in Europe, where she refined her technical skills, developed her distinctive aesthetic, and contributed costume work to the internationally acclaimed television series Bridgerton. These experiences continue to shape her practice, infusing her work with a rare combination of refinement, innovation, and cultural depth. After refining her executed craftsmanship and narrative form practice in Europe and contributing costume work to international productions, Xavier returned to the U.S. to develop her label, Valentina Ventura XX. Her work is defined by sculptural silhouettes, meticulous hand stitching, and a sophisticated modern edge that merges elegance with conceptual daring. I'm genuinely proud of this show and of the curatorial work that went into it, Vasquez said of Xavier's Gallery Marquee exhibit. Working with Rochelle has been such a great process. She trusted the vision, and together we were able to create something truly special for the community. The upcoming artist talk with Xavier on Saturday, December 13th, from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the gallery, is free and open to the public, and will feature an intimate conversation with the artist about exploring her creative path, artistic influences, and the meticulous craftsmanship behind her work. In other gallery news, Vasquez recently shared that this will be the last show they are doing in their current space, as they need to find a new gallery home soon. "We are on the hunt for a fabulous space and feeling positive," she said. Gallery Marquee is closing out the year with a bang, looking forward to 2026. And Dina Vasquez contributed to this story. So this should be interesting on the December 13th when they'll be discussing the exhibit and to find out how she started and why did she go into this, you know? All right, here we go. Now there's something here on immigration. Judge orders release of immigrant with ties to the White House press secretary. Concord, New Hampshire. A Brazilian woman with family ties to the White House press secretary, Caroline Levitt, will be released from ICE custody while she fights potential deportation, an immigration judge ruled Monday. Bruna Freria, 33, a longtime Massachusetts resident, was previously engaged to Levitt's brother, Michael. She was driving to pick up their 11-year-old son in New Hampshire when she was arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in Revere, Mass. On November 12th. Ferreria later was moved to a detention facility in Louisiana, where an immigration judge ordered that she be released on $1,500 bond, her attorney Tom Palero said. "We argue that she wasn't a danger or a flight risk," he said in a text message. "The government stipulated to our agreement and never once argued that she was a criminal, illegal alien and waived appeal." The Department of Homeland Security previously called Ferreira a criminal illegal alien and said she had been arrested for battery, an allegation her attorney denied. Neither department nor the White House press secretary responded to requests for comment on Monday. Pomerlo said his client came to the U.S. as a toddler and later enrolled in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the Obama-era policy that shields immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. He said she was in the process of applying for a green card. Carolyn Levitt grew up in New Hampshire and made an unsuccessful run for Congress from the state in 2022, before becoming Trump's spokesperson for his 2024 campaign and later joining him at the White House. And now, this is also from Washington. Trump giving farmers $12 billion in aid. President Donald Trump announced a $12 billion farm aid package Monday, a boost to farmers who have struggled to sell their crops while getting hit by rising costs after the president raised tariffs on China as part of a broader trade war. He unveiled the plan Monday afternoon at a White House roundtable with Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins, lawmakers from farm states, and farmers who thanked him for the help. "With this bridge payment, we'll be able to farm another year," Iowa farmer Cord Holub told Trump during the event. Rollins put the immediate value of the program at $11 billion, money that the White House said will offer one-time payments to row crop farmers. Another billion will be put aside for specialty crops as the administration works to better understand the circumstances for those farmers, Rollins said. "The aid will move by the end of February," she said. "We looked at how they were hurt. to what extent they were hurt, Trump said, explaining how the administration came up with the size of the package. Trump said money for the program will come from the tariff revenue. Later this month, the USDA will use a formula that estimates production costs to come up with a per-acre payment for each type of crop. Payments will be capped at $155,000 per farm or person, and only entities that make less than $900,000 a year will be eligible for aid. That will limit payments to large farms, which was a criticism of farm aid Trump delivered in his first term. Farmers have backed Trump politically, but his aggressive trade policies and frequently changing tariff rates have come under increasing scrutiny because of the impact on the agricultural sector and because of broader consumer worries. The aid is the administration's latest effort to defend Trump's economic stewardship in an answer to voter angst about rising costs. Trump has been dismissive of the affordability issues at times, but on Tuesday he is set to travel to Pennsylvania to talk about how his administration is trying to address a concern that is important for voters. Soybeans and sorghum were hit the hardest by Trump's trade dispute with China because more than half of those crops are exported each year, with most of the harvest going to China. In October, after Trump met Chinese leader Xi Jinping in South Korea, the White House said Beijing had promised to buy at least 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans by the end of the calendar year, plus 25 million metric tons a year in each of the next 3 years. China is the world's largest buyer of soybeans, but in recent years, it has increasingly been shifting its purchases over to Brazil and other South American nations. China has purchased more than 2.8 million metric tons of soybean since Trump announced the agreement at the end of October. That's only about one quarter of what administration officials said China had promised. But Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said China is on track to meet its goal by the end of February, which is 2 months later than the White House originally promised. The size of the $12 billion aid package is roughly the value of total U.S. soybean exports to China in 2024 and half the total exports of U.S. farm goods to China in 2024. Farmers appreciate the package, but they say it's likely only a down payment on what's needed, and government aid doesn't solve the fundamental problems of soaring costs in uncertain markets. During Trump's first term, he gave farmers more than $22 billion in aid payments in 2019 at the start of his trade war with China, and nearly $46 billion in 2020, although that year also included aid related to the COVID pandemic. Farmers say want to make a profit of selling their crops, not rely on the government to survive. That's a start, but I think we need to be looking for some avenues to find other funding opportunities, and we need to get our markets going. That's where we want to be able to make a living from, said Caleb Ragland, a Kentucky farmer who serves as president of the American Soybean Association. Most at risk are younger farmers and those who rent instead of own their land because they don't have much ability to borrow against the equity in their farms. If farmers can't make ends meet this year, there could be additional consolidation in the industry, with giant industrial farms getting bigger and the number of smaller family farmers continuing to shrink. Iowa farmer Rob Edwalt is in a difficult position because he only owns 160 of the 2,000 acres he farms. So he's selling some of his equipment that's not essential and looking into whether he could pick up some overnight trucking jobs to help raise some cash. It is to the point where I don't want to saddle my kid with the kind of stress that my wife and I are under right now, Ewald said. But fourth-generation Minnesota farmer Darren Johnson said he's more optimistic than most farmers will be able to endure the latest trade war. A lot of farms are pretty well established, and they have the equity to be able to still keep borrowing money to get through tougher times like this. Trump has also been under pressure to address soaring beef prices. Trump has asked the Department of Justice to investigate foreign-owned meat packers he accused of driving up the price of beef, although he has not provided evidence to back his claims. On Saturday, Trump signed an executive order directing the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission to look at anti-competitive behavior in food supply chains, including seed, fertilizer, and equipment, and consider taking enforcement actions and developing new regularities. Well, this has been a problem since the fall, so hope something can get resolved. And now we're still back to Washington. Supreme Court seems likely to back Trump's power to fire independent agency board members. The Supreme Court on Monday seemed likely to expand presidential control over independent federal agencies, signaling support for President Donald Trump's firing of board members. The court's conservative majority suggested it would overturn a unanimous 90-year-old decision that is limited when presidents can fire agencies' board members, in part to try to ensure decision-making free of political influence, or leave it with only its shell intact. Justice Brett Kavanaugh said the crux of the issue is that the officials who direct the agencies are exercising massive power over individual liberty in billion-dollar industries without being accountable to anyone. Liberal justices warned that a ruling sought by the administration to overturn the decision known as Humphrey's Executor would give the president, as Justice Elena Kagan said, massive, unchecked, uncontrolled power. Agencies that have been in place for a century or more would be robbed of their expertise, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said. So having a president come in and fire all the scientists and the doctors and the economists and the PhDs and replacing them with loyalists and people who don't know anything is actually not in the best interest of the citizens of the United States, Jackson said. No president before Trump has sought to wrest control of the agencies that regulate wide swaths of American life, including nuclear energy, product safety, and labor relations. But the six conservatives, including three appointed by Trump, seem more concerned about issuing a ruling that would endure than handling too much power to Trump. Their rhetoric was reminiscent of the presidential immunity case in 2024 that allowed Trump to avoid prosecution for his efforts to undo the 2020 election results. The court is writing a decision for the ages, Justice Neil Gorsuch said then. Solicitor General D. John Sauer, who argued the immunity case for Trump, defended the president's decision to fire Federal Trade Commission member Rebecca Slaughter without cause and called on the court to jettison Humphrey's executor. Sauer said the decision hasn't withstood the test of time and it had enabled a headless fourth branch of government, the administrative state the conservatives and business interests have been taking aim at for decades. Chief Justice John Roberts referred to Humphrey's executor as a dried husk. The conservative side of the court has already signaled support for the administration's position over the liberals' objection by allowing Slaughter and the board members of other agencies be removed from their jobs, even as their legal challenges continue. Members of the National Labor Relations Board, the Merit System, excuse me, Protection Board and the Consumer Product Safety Commission also have been fired by Trump. The only officials who have so far survived efforts to remove them are Lisa Cook, a Federal Reserve governor, and Shara Perlmutter, a copyright official with the Library of Congress. The court had suggested that it will view the Fed differently from other independent agencies, and Trump has said he wants her out because of allegations of mortgage fraud. Cook said she did nothing wrong. A second question in the Slaughter case could affect Cook, even if a firing turns out to be illegal. The court wants to decide whether judges have the power to reinstate someone. Gorsuch wrote earlier this year that FIRE employees who win in court could likely get back pay, but not reinstatement. That might affect Cook's ability to remain in her job. The justices have seemed wary about the economic uncertainty that might result if Trump can fire the leaders of the central bank. The court will hear separate arguments in January about whether Cook can remain in her job as her court challenge proceeds. Kavanaugh signaled that he is inclined to side with Cook, describing as an in-run the idea that an illegally fired official would only be entitled to her salary. Under Roberts' leadership, the court has issued a series of decisions dating back to 2010 that have steadily whittled away at laws restricting the president's ability to fire people. In 2020, Roberts wrote for the court, "The president's removal power is the rule, not the exception." In a decision upholding Trump's firing of the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, despite job protections similar to those upheld in Humphrey's case. In the 2024 immunity decision, Roberts included the power to fire among the president's conclusive and preclusive powers that Congress lacks the authority to restrict. The court also was dealing with an FTC member who was fired by President Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, who preferred his own choice at an agency that had a lot more say about the New Deal. William Humphrey refused Roosevelt's requests for his resignation. After Humphrey died the next year, the person charged with administering his estate, Humphrey's executor, sued for back pay. The justices unanimously upheld the law establishing the FTC and limiting the president to removing a commission only for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. And there's a lot to be, we have to watch this really, really carefully, because they really have to prove all of those if they're going to fire somebody. But if they, and listen to what they really have been doing. Now here to something that's lighter. It's the theater. Stratton Players to perform every Christmas story ever told. And this is from Fitchburg. For director and actor Chelsea Patrice, this winter's production, Every Christmas Story Ever Told, and then some, by Michael Carleton, James Fitzgerald, and John K. Alvarez, has been a labor of love and a production filled with more props than ever. Tickets are now on sale for the upcoming performances on Friday, December 12th at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, December 13th at 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. at Christ Church Guildhall, 569 Main Street. The show was such a smash last season that we didn't want to have our centennial winter show to be anything else, says Stratton Players Chair Sally Cragen. Plus, Chelsea convinced the entire original cast to return this year for full 2 weekends with even more props, more tech, and more sugar-fueled nonsense. The premise is one we can all relate to, said John Williams of Leominster, who plays an actor named John. A small theater company is determined to put on a serious and quality rendition of Dickens' Christmas Carol. However, Sam, played by Samantha Sikora Zavea, has an ambitious and highly comical plan that the small company should perform every Christmas story ever told. She drags John, Chelsea, played by Chelsea Patrice of Westminster, and a stage manager, played by Jen Knight of Leominster, on a wild ride. Sam's character drags the reluctant cast and the unsuspecting audience on a madcap romp through the holiday season, and their performance includes global Christmas traditions, seasonal icons from ancient times, to pop culture, almost every carol ever sung. "There are so many props, we bet you can't count them all," Cragen said with a smile. Stratton Players will be collecting donations of canned goods and boxed snacks for children, which will be donated to Fitchburg Public Schools for school-based pantries for families. Whether you love the holiday season or hate it, Stratton Players promises you love every Christmas every told, said Patrice. General admission is $15 and $10 for seniors and students. This show is appropriate for all ages. Now, tickets are available online at zephy.com. Search for Stratton Players, or by emailing strattonplayers@gmail.com. It sounds wonderful. Sounds like a fun production. And now we're going to go to Westford. Neshoba Tech debuts brand new cosmetology space and hair salon. Cosmetology instructors at Neshoba Valley Technical High School put a giant pair of scissors to good use recently, cutting a ribbon to officially open the newly renovated space for the in-school salon Cosmo Cuts. Seda Betzold, the lead instructor, thanked everyone who supported us through this exciting transformation. "Our students now have a state-of-the-art learning environment designed for collaboration across all grade levels," she added, "complete with a gorgeous lobby and fully equipped salon area to welcome our public clients, plus a modern theory space for classroom-style learning. We can't wait to see our future stylists shine in their new space." Now, Cosmo Cuts is open to the public on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays when school is in session from 9 a.m. to noon. Call 978-692-9601 to make an appointment. So that's fun. You can have your hair done. Let's see. We're going to skip about Luigi. And I don't think we're going to be doing the obituary. Let's see, what's next? Here we go, from Texas. Jasmine Crocker to run for the U.S. Senate seat. Democratic Rep. Jasmine Crocker launched a campaign Monday for the U.S. Senate in Texas, bringing a national profile to a race that may be critical to Democrats' long-shot hopes of reclaiming a Senate majority in next year's midterm election. Crockett, one of Congress's most outspoken Democrats and a frequent target of GOP attacks, jumped into the race on the final day of qualifying in Texas. She is seeking the Senate seat held by Republican John Cornyn, who is running for re-election in the GOP-dominated state. Democrats need a net gain of 4 Senate seats to wrest control from Republicans next November, when most of the seats up for re-election are in states like Texas that President Donald Trump won last year. Democrats have long hoped to make Texas more competitive after decades of Republican dominance. Cornyn, first elected to the Senate since 2002, is facing the toughest GOP primary of his career against Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and U.S. Rep. Wesley Hunt. Crockett's announcement came hours after former Representative Colin Allred ended his own campaign for the Democratic nomination in favor of attempting a House comeback bid. She faces a March 3rd primary against Democratic State Rep. James Tallarico, a former teacher with a rising national profile, fueled by viral social media posts challenging Republican policies such as private school vouchers and requiring the Ten Commandments in classrooms. It's going to be a sprint from now until the primary, but in Texas, you have to think about the voter base overall in November, too, said Carmel Marshall, a Democratic consultant who has worked for All Red before and worked on other campaigns in Texas. Who can do the work on the ground? After the primary, who can win in the general? Tallarico raised almost $6.3 million in the 3 weeks after he formally organized his primary campaign committee in September and had nearly $5 million in cash on hand at the end of the month, campaign finance reports showed. Crockett raised about $2.7 million for her House campaign fund from July through September and ended September with $4.6 million. Crockett could test Democratic voters' appetite for a blunt communicator who was eager to take on Republicans as Democrats pursue their first statewide victory in Texas since 1994. She did not issue a statement ahead of a formal announcement of her candidacy on Monday afternoon in Dallas. Republicans were quick Monday to try to turn Crockett's penchant for public clashes with opponents into liabilities. Paxton called her Crazy Crockett, and Cornyn described her as radical, theatrical, and ineffective. Tallarico welcomed Crockett to the Democratic primary, but pointed to his fundraising and said he has 10,000 volunteers. "Our movement is rooted in unity over division," he said in a statement. Democrats see their best opportunity to pick up the Texas seat if Paxton wins the Republican nomination because he had been shadowed for much of his career by legal and personal issues. Yet Paxton is popular with Trump's most ardent supporters. Hunt, who has served two terms representing a Houston area district, defied GOP leaders by entering the GOP race. Crockett, a civil rights attorney serving her second House term, built her national profile with a candid style and viral moments on Capitol Hill. Trump has noticed and called her a low IQ person. In response, Crockett said she would agree to take an IQ test against the president. She traded insults with Representative Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, who announced last month that she would resign in January and had heated exchanges with Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina. She also mocked Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who uses a wheelchair as Governor Hot Wheels. Later, she said she was referring to Abbott's policy of using planes, trains, and automobiles to send thousands of immigrants in Texas illegally to Democratic-led cities. Democrats' best showing in a statewide race in the past three decades was in 2018, when former U.S. Rep. Beto O'Rourke came in within 3 points of ousting Republican Senator Ted Cruz. It was the midterm election of Trump's first administration, and Democrats believed next year's race could be similarly favorable to their party. A former professional football player and civil rights attorney, Allred was among Democrats' star recruits in 2018. Allred lost to Cruz by 8.5 points last year. He is running for House in a Dallas-Fort Worth area district under a new map approved this year by GOP-controlled Texas legislature to meet Trump's call for more winnable Republican seats. The district has some areas Allred represented for 6 years before his run for the Senate in 2024. An internal party ballot, Allred said, would prevent the Democratic Party from going into this critical election unified against the danger posted to our communities and our Constitution by Donald Trump and one of his Republican bootlickers. Marshall said Crockett is a solid national figure who has a large social media following and is a frequent presence on cable news. That could be an advantage with Democratic primary voters, Marshall said, but not necessarily afterward. Tallarico, meanwhile, must raise money and build name recognition to make the leap from the Texas House of Representatives to a strong statewide candidacy. A winning Democratic candidate in Texas, Marshall said, would have to energize black voters, mainly in Metro Houston and Dallas, win the kind of diverse suburbs and experts like those Allred once represented in Congress, and get enough rural votes, especially among Latino in the Rio Grande Valley. It's about building complicated coalitions in a big state, Marshall said. This is going to be a very, very close call that we're going to have to watch. Really, now let's go to the Middle East. The agent says Israeli police forcibly entered its Jerusalem compound. All right, and this is from Jerusalem. Israeli police forcibly entered the compound of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees in East Jerusalem early Monday, escalating a campaign against the organization that has been banned from operating on Israeli territory. The UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, said in a statement that sizable numbers of Israeli forces, including police on motorcycles, trucks, and forklifts, entered the compound in the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The unauthorized and forceful entry by the Israeli security forces is an unacceptable violation of UNRWA's privileges and immunities as a UN agency, the statement said. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said he will meet with U.S. President Donald Trump on December 29th, although Israel did not confirm the location of the meeting. On Monday, Netanyahu met with U.S. officials in Jerusalem about collaboration on the U.S. brokered plans on the future of Gaza. The raid was the latest in Israel's campaign against the agency, which provides aid and services to some 2.2 million Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, as well as 3 million more refugees in Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. Photos taken by an Associated Press photographer show police erecting an Israeli flag on the compound and police cars on the street. Photos provided by UNRWA staff show a group of Israeli police officers in the compound. Police said in a statement they entered for a debt collection procedure initiated by Jerusalem's municipal government, which did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The agency was established to help the estimated 700,000 Palestinians who fled or were driven out of what is now Israel during the 1948 war surrounding the creation of the Israeli state. UNRWA supporters said Israel hopes to erase the Palestinian refugee issue by dismantling the agency. Israel says the refugees should be permanently resettled outside the borders. For months following the start of the Israel-Hamas war that began on October 7, 2023, UNRWA was the main lifeline for Gaza's population during Israel's offensive there. Throughout the war, Israel has accused the agency of being infiltrated by Hamas, using its facility and taking aid, claims for which have been provided little evidence. The UN has denied it. Israel also has claimed that hundreds of Palestinian militants work for UNRWA. UNRWA has denied knowingly aiding armed groups and says it quickly acts to purge any suspected militants. After months of attacks from Netanyahu and his far-right allies, Israeli ban UNRWA from operating on its territory in January. The U.S., formerly the largest donor to UNRWA, altered funding to the agency in early 2024. UNRWA has since struggled to continue its work in Gaza with other UN agencies, including the World Food Program and UNICEF, stepping in. Tamara Al-Rifai, UNRWA's Director of External Relations and Communication, said UNRWA has been excluded from ceasefire talks. If you squeeze UNRWA out, what other agency can fill that void? Al-Rifai said. On Monday, Israeli government spokesman Shosh Bedrosian called UNRWA a stain on the United Nations, which has perpetuated the problem of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA has proven its enormous failures, and it's time for it to be dismantled, she said. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres strongly condemns the unauthorized entry to the compound. And Guterres urges Israel to immediately take all necessary steps to restore, preserve, and uphold the inviolability of UNRWA premises and refrain from taking any further action with regard to UNRWA premises in line with Israel's obligation under the Charter of the UN and other obligations of the international law. Now, Netanyahu met with U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Mike Waltz, and other officials on Monday in a visit the Trump administration said was aimed at pushing forward the U.S.-drafted 20-point plan for Gaza that includes current ceasefire and following stages. Israel government later said Trump and Netanyahu would meet on December 29 to discuss the future steps and phrases and international force stabilization force of the ceasefire. One of the thorniest issues in the U.S. brokered agreement has been the demand for Hamas to disarm. On Sunday, Hamas expressed some willingness to draw down its arsenal. As senior Hamas officials told the AP, the group is ready to discuss freezing or storing or laying down its weapons. With the remains of one hostage in Gaza yet to be handed over to Israel, Arab and Western officials have said they expect an international governing body in Gaza to be announced in the few weeks. A search was underway on Monday for the hostages' remains, Hamas said. Waltz met with the parents of the last hostage, Israeli policeman Ron Gvli. On Monday, Gvli's parents urged Waltz not to move to the second stage of the ceasefire until their son's remains are returned. On Sunday, Waltz met with Jordan's King Abdullah II and Foreign Minister Ayam Safadi and discussed expanding humanitarian aid for Gaza. The war started when Hamas-led militants attacked southern Israel, leaving about 1,200 people dead and abducting 251 others. Israelis' retaliatory offensive has killed 70,365 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry. The ministry also said over 376 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes since the ceasefire took effect in October. Violence has risen in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, where Israel's military shot and killed one man Sunday night who was accused of throwing rocks with soldiers. At soldiers, with two others. The man that was killed is a 19-year-old from the northern city of Quaquida. And there is a construction of a barrier along Israeli-Jordan border. They have this barrier. It's 50 miles or 80 kilometers along the border with Jordan. The construction was aimed at preventing efforts of Iran and its proxies to establish an eastern front against the state of Israel. The border will include increased security. And this was all written by the press, Associated Press writer Youssef Federman in Doha, Qatar, and Melanie Lidman in Tel Aviv. Israel also contributed to this report. Okay, so it's quite a lengthy report. Now, the other terrible, terrible thing in this world is the Ukraine war. And this is from London. President Vladimir Zelensky met British, French, and German leaders in London on Monday in a show of European support for Ukraine in what they call a critical moment in the U.S.-led effort to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Prime Minister Keir Starmer held talks with Zelensky, French President Emmanuel Macron, and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz at the British leader's 10 Downing Street residence to try to strengthen Ukraine's hand amid mounting impatience from President Donald Trump. After the meeting, Starmer, Zelensky, and other leaders called Kiev's European allies, urging them to keep up the pressure on Russian President Vladimir Putin. The leaders all agreed that now is a critical moment and that we must continue to ramp up support to Ukraine and economic pressure on Putin to bring an end to this barbaric war, Starmer's office said in a statement. This is the furthest we got in 4 years, and we welcome the fact that these talks are continuing at every level, said Starmer's spokesman Tom Wells. He added that intensive work will continue in the days ahead, although there are still outstanding issues. Macron's office said the session allowed the leaders to continue joint work on the U.S. plan in order to complement it with the European contributions in close coordination with Ukraine. Answering reporters' questions in a WhatsApp chat later Monday, Zelensky said the current U.S. peace plan differs from earlier versions, and now that it has 20 points down from 28, after what he called some obvious anti-Ukrainian points were removed. On security guarantees, Zelensky said the main questions to be resolved are, what if after the end of the war, Russia will start another aggression? What will the partners be ready for? What could Ukraine count on? The answer to these questions must be in the core of the security guarantees for Ukraine, he said. In an exchange of reporters on Sunday night, Trump appeared frustrated with Zelensky, claiming the Ukrainian leader hasn't yet read the proposal. Zelensky said Monday that Trump certainly wants to end the war. Surely he has his own vision. We live here. From within, we see details and nuances. We perceive everything much deeper because this is our motherland. Starmer, Macron, and Merz took a more supportive stance toward Kiev in comments before their Monday meeting, which lasted 2 hours. The UK leader said the push for peace was at a critical stage and stressed the need for a just and lasting ceasefire. Merz, meanwhile, said he was skeptical about some details in documents released by the U.S. We have to talk about it. That's why we're here. The coming days could be a decisive time for all of us. European leaders are working to ensure that any ceasefire is backed by solid security guarantees from Europe and the U.S. to deter Russia from attacking again. Trump has not given explicit guarantees in public. Zelensky said late Saturday that his talk with European leaders this week in London and Brussels will focus on security, air defense, and long-term funding for Ukraine's war effort. He said Monday that Ukraine needs support from both the U.S. and Europe. There are some things we can't manage without the Americans, things which we can't manage without Europe, and that's why we need to make important decisions, he said at Downing Street. Starmer's office said the leaders instructed their national security advisers to continue discussions in the coming days, underscoring the need for a just and lasting peace in Ukraine, which includes robust security guarantees. The U.S. and Ukrainian negotiations completed 3 days of talks on Saturday, aimed at trying to narrow differences on the U.S. administration's peace proposal. Zelensky said on Telegram that talks had been substantive and that National Security and Defense Council Secretary Rustam Umarov and Chief of Staff Andrei Hantov were traveling back to Europe to brief him. A major sticking point in the plan is the suggestion that Kiev must cede control of the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to Russia, which illegally occupies most, but not all, of the territory. Ukraine and its European allies have balked the idea of handing over land. Stama said he won't be putting pressure on Zelensky to accept a police settlement. Peace. Trump has had a hot and cold relationship with Zelensky since winning a second term, insisting the war was a waste of U.S. taxpayers' money. Trump has also repeatedly urged the Ukrainians to cede the land to Russia to end the conflict. I mean, who started this conflict? Think about that. U.S. releases national security strategy. The European talks followed the publication of a new U.S. national security strategy that alarmed European leaders and is welcomed by Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the document, which spells out the administration's core foreign policy interests, was largely in line with Moscow's vision. The nuances that we see in the new concept certainly look appealing to us, he said. On Monday, it mentions the need for dialogue and building constructive, friendly relations. This cannot but appeal to us and absolutely corresponds to our vision. We understand that by eliminating the irritants that currently exist in bilateral relation, a prospect may open for us to resolve our relations and bring them out of the deep crisis. Document released Friday by the White House said the U.S. wants to improve its relationship with Russia after years of Moscow being treated as a global pariah and ending the war is a core U.S. interest. The document also says NATO must not be a perpetually expanding alliance, echoing another compliant by Russia. It was scathing about migration and free speech policies of long-standing U.S. allies in Europe. Stama's government declined to comment on the document, calling it a matter for the U.S. government. And while they're doing this, Russia continue attacking Ukraine amid diplomatic efforts. Its drones struck high-rise apartments in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Okhotrykra overnight, injuring 7 people and extensively damaging the building. In the northern city of Chernihiv, a Russian drone exploded outside a residential building, injuring 3 people and damaging a kindergarten, gas lines, and cars. Ukraine's Air Force said Russia fired 149 drones overnight, with 131 neutralized and 16 others striking their targets. Meanwhile, Russia defenses destroyed 67 Ukrainian drones overnight, the Russian Defense Ministry said. Now, this was reported from Kiev, Ukraine, by Nikovov. People have to remember who started this and why. And that's what you really have to do it. Now, we'll just think about, the past a little bit and look at today in history. In 2014, the U.S. Senate investigators concluded that the United States had brutalized scores of terrorist suspects with interrogation tactics that turned secret CIA prisons into chambers of suffering and did nothing to make Americans safer after the September 11th, 2001 attack. 1854, Alfred Law Tennyson's famous poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, was published in England. 1911, an explosion inside Cross Mountain coal mine near Briceville, Tennessee, killed 84 workers. 1917, British forces captured Jerusalem from the Ottoman Turks. Wow, I thought it was longer ago than that. 1965, A Charlie Brown Christmas, the first animated TV special featuring characters from Peanuts comic strip by Charles Schulz, premiered on CBS. 1987, the first Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, began as riots broke out in Gaza and spread to the West Bank. Nothing's changed. 1990, Solidarity found a Lech Walesa won Poland's presidential runoff by a landslide. 92, Britain's Prince Charles and Princess Diana announced their separation. 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered a temporary halt in the Florida vote count on which Al Gore pinned his best hopes of winning the White House. 2006, a fire broke out at a Moscow drug treatment hospital, killing 46 women and trapped by barred windows at a locked gate. 2011, the European Union said 26 of its 27 member countries were open to joining a new treaty, tying their finances together to solve the euro crisis. Britain remained unopposed. And 2020, commercial flights with Boeing 737 MAX jetliners resumed for the first time since they were grounded for 2 years following two deadly accidents. And, you know, let's see, we had a big earthquake in Japan, 7.5 quake, and that triggered a tsunami, and good luck to everybody there. So I'm sorry I don't have any more joyful stories. It didn't get, nothing joyful was in here, but you heard about the play. That was really good. And the exhibit, that's really going to be great. So for all of you, I'm going to say it's a bitterly cold day. If you can get out and have a little bit of a walk, it would be good. I think Dorothy probably would like to get out for a few hours or an hour or so. I hope she can. All of you have a good day and enjoy. It's December. Enjoy the cold. All right. Bye.